Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 83, section 4, which is old single column, page 924. Let's see. We got into this paper a little ways. You might want to just flip back and remind yourself of what we've built up to here. We had courtship and betrothal, purchase and dowry. Remember, this paper is entitled "The Marriage Institution." So we're going through these details in that more formal fashion, less about kind of the unconscious evolution of folkways and mores and just predicated on biologic evolution, and more on an ever more conscious effort to engage this issue of mating and the resultant children to have ways of coordinating those relationships and the resultant family into the system of society in an ever more conscious way, like I said, and hence more and more it's what's, can be thought of in a little bit more separate fashion as the evolution of society rather than just merely the evolution of biology and the mind changes, developments that go with that. Okay, so taking on more and more of an independence from mere biologic instinctual reactions and behaviors. Okay, so now we're ready to actually take that next step and think about ideas to, you might say, consecrate the pairing. And I won't say a lot more because they're going to develop as we read here. So we not only going to have, we not only now have what we can officially think of as marriage, but a wedding to go with it. Okay, let's see what they say here.
4, the wedding ceremony. The wedding ceremony grew out of the fact that marriage was originally a community affair, not just the culmination of a decision of two individuals. Mating was of group concern as well as a personal function.
Okay, so the first thing that strikes you as odd, about this is, okay, we just started this topic, and they give us a single sentence, opening paragraph. Well, I guess that's two sentences, and then one tiny little sentence at the end. But a tiny little opening paragraph, and then separated by a large paragraph break. So they want you to take a deep breath and reflect for a moment before you've barely gotten started. It's like, well, you haven't really said anything yet, have you? I mean, why are you making me take this big, deep break, and consider before you go any further? The main reason I was stressing at the end of the last session, as we were contemplating issues with that closing paragraph in the preceding section, there are lots and lots and lots of things that came to pass in the evolutionary process, often long ago for very rudimentary and primitive reasons, when one considers them, one might be inclined to just say, oh, well, this is all just completely arbitrary. Let's just toss this all aside, and either make something totally new divorced from the old, or maybe you decide it's all pointless. I mean, you know, meaningless. I mean, you know, I don't need anything at all. Remember, we were talking about that whole issue of, you know, because especially when the revelators stress some, you know, very limited reason why something came into existence, you know, your idealism is all the more inclined to want to just toss the baby out with the bathwater, as we say all the time. But the challenge is to not do that, to recognize there's always a truth flowing through a phenomenon. And a lot of times, all you need to do, you don't really have to maybe change much of anything in terms of the basic mechanics of what you're doing, whatever, you know, the ritual or the symbol or whatever. You can just think of it anew. You can look at it from a higher vantage point and see it with a higher purpose. You know, like I was just saying, which is probably not that difficult, since some of these things started with a very lowly purposing, you know, some very superstitious or rudimentary, you know, notion behind why they were, you know, people were going to do something or other. And, you know, and so when they say, the wedding ceremony grew out of the fact that marriage was originally a community affair. So you go, well, okay, just stop right there. I mean, we now believe in this very definitive individual choice of a couple apart from anything else. So that means we should just throw out weddings. You know, if all it is just a vestige of when it was a community affair. And it's like, no. They want you to not think simplistically like that. You know, like they're saying, you know, it's not just the culmination of a decision of two individuals. And when they say, you know, then they give you that final statement of mating was of group concern as well as a personal function. You know, and like I said, your response to that isn't, well, not anymore. You know, we've left that primitive stuff behind. It's like, now why was it a group concern in the past? What was the thread of truth flowing through that? And what needs to be conserved and taken forward into the future relative to that? That's the point, which is obviously not at all apparent, is it? And there's no hints in that little paragraph that you're supposed to do what I'm just doing, what I'm doing right now. But I can remind you that just when we were unpacking things, it coincidentally came out that we were talking about such matters just before we read this. You know, when we were finishing the preceding paragraph last week, preceding section last week. Okay, so it's basically, you know, an issue of noticing that large paragraph break. And being willing to to pause yourself and try to figure out why they did that to you. You know, there's lots of reasons for large paragraph breaks in the book, so you can't, if you figure it out in one instance, you can't apply that to every instance. There's a lot of different reasons, but that's definitely what the deal is here. You know, it's just that opening little statement that you can see now that I've pointed it out to you, has that contrast between what was and what is, right? I mean, you know, you should be able to, you know, if you're looking for something in that paragraph to play off of, you know, there really isn't much else to find but that fact, right? So you could eventually get to it, if you spend enough time at it, so it's just, just take the time as I stress so often, when you're studying the book, to not let the little things pass you by. It's those little things, you know, especially even little things that aren't even words. You know, like large paragraph breaks or italicization or capitalization or not capitalization. You know, why did they capitalize this word here and not there? You know, those sorts of things. It's those little subtleties that are trying to get you to reflect where you have some hope of getting something besides the facts of the words in the book. Especially like when you're reading a paper like this, just the historic facts, you know, at that. You're trying to find the revelation of truth, and you can't read that. You know, there isn't a single word in this book that's truth. Truth can't be conveyed with words. It's just a bunch of facts. And you have to go in quest of that invisible recognition of truth. But obviously, the moment you depart from something that is trying to kind of keep you grounded, like, you know, ink blobs on a piece of paper. It's like, well, that's an F, you know, it's not an M. I mean, you know, you can't really fly off in an imaginative tangent, you know, and imagine that F is an M. It looks like an F. But once you leave what is directly visible and try to get to truth, it's a double-edged sword. You know, you can just as easily get error. And so when you leave the immediacy of the words, if the context that you are working in is your preconceived opinion, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices, you won't find one whit of truth in the Urantia book. I mean, everything you interpret will be erroneous, inescapably. Right? If you use current scientific assumptions, you'll interpret everything in the book erroneously. You know, if you use current paleontological assumptions or religious assumptions, you'll interpret everything in the book erroneously. Now, that's the big challenge, like I point out all the time. I mean, I know I'm going off on this big tangent, but I'm just, you know, this is a great opportunity. It's like, why on earth do they have this tiny little paragraph starting this thing out, you know, with a large paragraph break? And I'm just trying to point out it's that whole bigger overarching fact that's between the lines there that they're trying to get you to eventually engage the book in that mode.
Right. What is the truth in that first sentence?
Well, no, I mean, well, that's...
What do you think it is? It's not in the words.
I mean, well, what we're going to do as we go forward in the section is we're going to be kind of looking for additional clues about this. It's like, well... Now, tell me more about it being a group concern, okay, so I can reflect on this a little bit more. I mean, maybe I can begin to get an idea of how it isn't just old modalities that don't have any validity anymore or any application anymore. Maybe there's something there. Maybe there's an essence in those old ideas that, you know, I can put in an improved context.
So it was more than a mores of that time, so to speak. There's what you're saying. I mean, to me, just looking at it, reading it, it looks like that truth could possibly be, well, you know, maybe there's something true to the fact that that's a good way to go about things, that it's not just a decision between two people, though that's important,
mm-hmm.
but to have, you know, whether it's the group or the clan or the family or whatever they're talking about in terms of a larger mm-hmm. group, be also involved is maybe important for whether it's genetic reasons or family growth reasons or educational reasons or whatever, has value.
Yeah, right. I mean, and see, that's it's exactly those sorts of things. They won't always spoon feed those recognitions to you, but they'll give you, like I said, if you're kind of heightened to that at the beginning of a section like this, as you go forward, you're looking for little clues that you can leverage off of and go, oh, I see. They needed a group for that reason back then. Well, we don't really need that now, but But I see other values in a group. It's more important for me to get you thinking about this independently yourself and just making these discoveries yourself than for me to sit here and talk endlessly and try to, you know, spoon feed, the entire unpacking of the revelation to you. I mean, because truth is something that only I can't give you. Truth is not knowledge. It's not a knowingness that can be given, right? That ledge part of the word knowledge is the giving part. You can't give truth. You can give what's called knowledge. You have to discover the truth of it within you. The moment, if I discover it within me, if I try to convey it to you, I have to downstep it and turn it into words and jiggle air molecules across the room to you. I mean, the moment that I turn it into words, it's dead. The truth dies the moment that you put it into words.
Until I pick it up.
Right, until you properly pick it up again, right, and follow it upward and find that dynamic experience in the upper domain of your mind again.
So yeah. Right then and there, does the spirit of truth come involved in that kind of situation?
Yeah, if you've developed enough of a relationship with the Holy Spirit that the spirit of truth has a context to function in, it will definitely foster that holistic dynamic synchronization, as opposed to the transcendent of the three point-like intuitions, if you will, of the three cosmic intuitions. The spirit of truth gives you a fourth intuition that's a more holistic insight, but an insight it is. Yeah, I mean it's there to catalyze that. That living synchronization. You know, if you've done your part, not to belabor this, but just to remind you again how other places in the book when they talk about the physics of that, you've got the problem of if I've drug scientific dictation, social usage, and religious dogma up into the upper domain. The hourglass analogy of my mindful self, and I've polluted the three cosmic intuitions, then, see, you don't have the predicate for truth up there now. That threefold fact that you drug in and put up there, in those seats of honor, if you will, I mean, they produce a sphere of error, not a sphere of truth. That's what I was saying before. If you have preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices that sort of live within you, that living wholeness that you bring things into, like the words of this book, is a sphere of error. Error is living too, just like truth. It's just that it's living unto you. See, that's the power of of your free will. You give life to things that really don't have life, right? Evil doesn't exist objectively out there. But if you give badness form in your mind, which is evil, right, it lives within you. You didn't grab a chunk of it out there and stick it inside of you. It doesn't exist out there. You brought it to life within you. You have the power, of bringing things to life within you with your free will. Be it error, evil, whatever. Yeah, or truth. See, or goodness. Yeah, and the challenge is to somehow be humble enough, sincere enough, to get to the positive blade of the double-edged sword rather than the negative blade. Because error is just as holistic and exciting and fulfilling as truth is subjectively. See, and if you don't really have that objective discrimination to tell the one from the other, the spirit of truth, see, is trying to help you, right? Discriminate between truth and error. If that isn't in play, error will seem every bit as fulfilling to you subjectively as truth. just like a figment, can be just as definitive to you as a fact. You know, the analogy I always use, you know, you grab a sphere and you go, yep, it's a fact. You know, I've run my hands over the entire surface of the sphere. It doesn't have a single divot in it. You know, it's just wonderfully spherical and contiguous. Yeah, well, have you looked inside? What? You know, with your insights, you can look inside and see if it's hollow or solid. If it's hollow, it's a figment. If it's solid, it's a fact. If it's hollow, it's error. If it's solid, it's truth. You know, without the insight, subjectively, they feel exactly the same. You can run your hands over a figment in your mind, and it will be just as definitive, you know, as the representation of an objective fact in your mind.
So as we evolve, do we get better at this?
Yeah, right. You are grown to be better and better at this. And, you know, like we say all the time, you can't cause that growth. All you can do is supply the favorable conditions to be grown and get better at this. Better and better and better. Loyal, you know, like I always say, start with the first five: loyal, humble, sincere, just, and patient. You know, nothing will get you to error quicker than impatience. Ask Adam and Eve. You know, and remember how definitive they were.
You were going to say, ask Lucifer.
You know, well, you know, that's you know, taking it to the next level. But you know, just ask Adam and Eve. You know, and remember how certain they were. It's like, oh yeah, this is rock solid truth. I mean, you know, they were running their hands over it, no doubt about it. It wasn't truth at all; it was error. You know, it's that spirit poison of impatience that invariably starts this unfortunate ball rolling, like it did with them. Okay, anyway, back to wedding ceremonies. We are actually trying to talk about wedding ceremonies and not these kind of overarching philosophic issues. But just remember, it's that kind of big picture that you're trying to assimilate what you're reading into. If you're just locked down in the word-to-word-to-word, dot-to-dot of the book, it's just blah, 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 you know, about some historical moire about wedding ceremonies.
Chris, quick question. You touched on it in the beginning, bringing your truth down to words, did you call that doctrinal level?
Right, you form a doctrine.
It's doctrine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, once it's doctrine, you have a tendency with your seventh adjutant to juice it up and make it dogma. You know, and not just merely doctrine.
Now, would you relate that to, maybe that's going a bit too far, but the Father is the thought, the Son is the Word, and the Spirit the act? Do you think that's a little...
Well, you know, we don't have to bring, you know, try to bring in that parallel. I mean,
sure.
You know, it's just more just, you know, words are knowledge. You know, they're a knowingness that can be given, right? Like it's been given to you. Here's a bunch of words that, you know, is on a book that I could hand to you, right? But the revelation of truth is not something that can be conveyed directly with words. Only suggested with words. Very well-crafted words and a very humble, sincere student can pick up on the proper suggestion, right, and get to the truth. Yeah, like I said, I mean, every once in a while, when it's a very, very, very difficult task, they'll actually say, "Now we're about to give you some words, and these are suggestions." They'll actually put the word "suggestion" in type to remind you of that. Right? They try to be suggested by what you're reading. Okay.
Magic, ritual, and ceremony surrounded the entire life of the ancients, and marriage was no exception. As civilization advanced, as marriage became more seriously regarded, the wedding ceremony became increasingly pretentious. Early marriage was a factor in property interests, even as it is today, and therefore required a legal ceremony. While the social status of subsequent children demanded the widest possible publicity. Primitive man had no records, Therefore, must the marriage ceremony be witnessed by many persons.
Okay, so the next paragraph, okay, they give you that basic foundational thing, you know, especially in the very last sentence there. Primitive man had no records. Okay, therefore, must the marriage ceremony be witnessed by many persons. Okay, so just merely because of that, right, it was made a group phenomenon. You see, and like I'm saying, it's like, well, I mean, you know, everyone's, you know, taking videos with their cell phones now. You know, it's like, yeah, we got records, you know, upon records now. There's, you know, everything is recorded now. You know, so we don't need all these people that can tell the story and witness to this or what, you know. But again, see, it's like, well, so should we just get rid of the wedding ceremony? Or is there something to this group thing? We'll comment as we go forward here, but you know, see, it's obviously being set up that you're supposed to think like about that issue. Now, notice what they have up front there. As civilization advanced, as marriage became more seriously regarded, okay, and this is always a problem. As soon as humans get really serious about something, okay, they start to take all sorts of minutia, even erroneous ideas and stuff, and existentialize them and absolutize them. And see, that's what happens when they get very serious about something. And as they say there, the wedding ceremony became increasingly pretentious. Right, as you try to somehow make molecules move about in a fancy enough fashion to conform to this exalted, serious notion that you have about this. It's like, no, the mints have to be this color. And no. They, you know, she has to walk from there to there, stop for 3 seconds, turn left. And, you know, we get all complicated about this. Because, you know, all of this moving of molecules is all about synchronizing with the existential domain, and right, it gets very complicated. Okay.
It's kind of fun.
it's fun, but of course, objectively, it's pretty funny. What we do with our, you know, to ourselves. Because we take something very, very seriously. And of course, it's not that we shouldn't take things seriously, but we have to appreciate we always have a tendency to overplay this. You know, and so that's one of the places you can look to. When you come out of the material comfort era, where things get more and more and more pretentious as the material comfort era continues to build, as you come out of the material comfort era into the quest for knowledge and wisdom, many things are going to simplify because you're going to see things more genuinely, objectively, and clearly, you're going to pare down all of the epicycles that you've constructed to make this thing fancy. You're going to recognize the few key cycles in it. And you're going to conserve those. You're going to take those forward in the future, right? You're going to see that red thread of truth that's flowing through it. But you're going to strip off all the superfluous, you know, edifices that you've built upon that thread of truth. Now, that's, and the reason you do that is, like I always stress, the name of that next developmental epic, the quest for knowledge and wisdom. Wisdom is the second word. Wisdom is the foundational word. You know, it's not wisdom and knowledge, bottom up. It's knowledge and wisdom. It's top down. You're going to approach things more top down, more objectively. You're going to see them for what they really are. Like you'll know that no real harm can befall you. And you'll see how silly and superfluous all your anxiety and fear is. Those sorts of things. We have to be understanding. You know, they're going to stress this as we go forward a little bit. We have to be understanding that we're in the material comfort era. And we're not, we're by no means just a hop, skip, and a jump away from it ending. We've got some stuff to work through here yet, especially since we're kind of slipping backwards. It means we have even more to work through. But, we have to understand that a lot of things just sort of have to be overly complex now. Your taxes, or a wedding ceremony or whatever it is, they just sort of have to be, because that's part of the process where we finally build things up to such extreme absurdities of complexity that even the dullest of us recognize how silly it is.
Like the last
one. Okay. right. Arguing about, who sits on the right hand, the left hand, blah, 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 blah. Yeah.
Well, I know more the ceremony behind it.
It's still ritualized. Yeah, the modern Last Supper, how it becomes ritualized. Yes, exactly, sure. But my point, just to put the two thoughts together, it started in that silly mode at the original Last Supper with them arguing about who's going to sit where and stuff. Again, you have this whole pretentious, false existentialization of things, that's there from the beginning, so don't be surprised if it continues to grow as time goes on. It's very difficult. The more idealistic our insight can be, the more we are aware of ideals, let's say it that way, the greater the tension between, what you recognize is what's really important. And it's like, look at all of this folderol that I'm expected to do. You get this greater and greater tension. And you have to resist that temptation to rebel. Right? Revolution is not the solution. Right? You have to patiently allow the evolutionary process to work forward. The degree to which you can, some leeway within the mores system, you can take the simpler path that's allowed. But, Jesus made sure that he, even in his public ministry, when he's kind of more in the, he's getting a little bit more in the Son of God mode than the Son of Man mode, and he's pushing on things in a way that, we shouldn't as just, creatures instead of creators. Even when he's in that a little bit more creator mode in his public ministry, he still is trying to be as respecting as he can be, and he's definitely telling everyone, absolutely no revolution. Right? It doesn't matter how much you come to recognize how corrupt your Jewish leaders are. You follow them. You don't, start a revolution against them. When it gets to the point where there's a real issue, the Most Highs will remove them. Okay? That's not your job to be a revolutionary agent. That's the Lucifer delusion. We have to be respecting as much as we can. We need to go along with the way the mores system is. But we can at least do what we can internally to be closer to the truth of it, less with the folderol of it. And we can try to be a suggestion of a future that's not here yet, right? We can try to guide things forward in our little, maybe we can change the angle of so that something's moving by half a degree in our lifetime. But you're probably not going to change it 180 degrees in your lifetime. So those sorts of, humble relationship to the evolutionary process. Okay, we worked that pretty well. But you notice that they remind you. It's not just then that when you had, when you literally might be thinking of women as property, that there's property interests. Everyone who's been married knows there's property interests still in play today. That's just inescapable. If you've got private property, marriage is going to involve property interests. And the solution is not to eliminate private property, because then you're eliminating civilization. So, again, these issues are in play. We have to deal with them.
At first, the wedding ceremony was more on the order of a betrothal. It consisted only in public notification of intention of living together. Later, it consisted in formal eating together. Among some tribes, the parents simply took their daughter to the husband. In other cases, the only ceremony was the formal exchange of presents, after which the bride's father would present her to the groom. Among many Levantine peoples, it was the custom to dispense with all formality, marriage being consummated by sex relations. The red man was the first to develop the more elaborate celebration of weddings.
Okay, so there we just get a little bit of an expansion on, yeah, what they were saying in that second paragraph, you know, before it became kind of hopelessly pretentious. It was sometimes extremely matter-of-fact. And so, they're going to mention this here in a little bit. You know, remember how little imagination evolutionary man has. So it's difficult for evolutionary man to get too fancy, to conceive of too many wheels within wheels about things. He has a tendency to be very matter-of-fact about it. It's like, well, it's just basically about the mating thing, so, well, that's the ceremony. Just very matter-of-fact about it.
And you're all invited.
Yeah, we haven't gotten to that yet. That's coming up. To give you a little bit of a sense, they're giving you a little bit of a sense of, you know, how it starts out in that very matter-of-fact mode. Now, at the very end, you know, they just tell you, point blank, the red man was the first to develop the more elaborate celebration of weddings. And I say, as you should say to yourself, why? Why red man? You know the answer. We talk about every time they tell you that red man was the first to do such and so, it's the same answer to every one of those why questions. Because they favor which adjutant? The sixth adjutant, right? That's their bias as red man. That's the adjutant they favor, right? That spear point adjutant. They're always going to, no matter what the subject is, they're going to have a tendency to be the point of the spear because of that. Whether it's on a normal world, red man crossing the will dignity threshold first, or what, they always tend to be the spear point. But here, right, if you favor that long-term unity consciousness adjutant of the sixth adjutant, it gives you a little bit of a more bias to imaginative, right? So he was the first to develop more elaborate, the more elaborate celebration of weddings. They're going to have just a little bit more of a tendency to think of it in fancified, what they think of as spiritual terms. Yeah. Like I stress so many times, that's, most people's definition still of spiritual is fancy mind, more imaginative mind, more, complex constructions of thought and whatnot. Fancy mind is spirit for almost everyone. Right? They don't think of spirit as some substance in the external world. Right, they think of it as something in their mind. It's like, well, man, it's not just a run-of-the-mill mind. Like when I'm thinking about, how to cook donuts, right? It's that really fancy stuff I think about sometimes. That's my spiritual nature. The red man is going to be the first to kind of get into that mode of. He's taking this seriously, thinking of it more related to existential, to eternity. In other words, it's more spiritual. In other words, it's more fancy mind. So the molecules have to do fancier things. We can't just have something simple in the external world. We've got to rearrange the molecules in fancy ways. Right? That's why he's doing it. All right, let's keep going.
Childlessness was greatly dreaded, and since barrenness was attributed to spirit machinations, efforts to ensure fecundity also led to the association of marriage with certain magical or religious ceremonials. And in this effort to ensure a happy and fertile marriage, many charms were employed. Even the astrologers were consulted to ascertain the birth stars of the contracting parties. At one time, the human sacrifice was a regular feature of all weddings among well-to-do people.
Now, there's a good reason not to go to the well-to-do people's wedding, lest you be the guest of honor. sorry, I can't make it that day.
give them my best.
especially if you're a virgin, you probably didn't want to go. Yeah. And there was a volcano nearby. They're going to continue on this theme. They're building up that. Again, when you start to take it seriously, right, then you start to think that that whole ghost land, spirit land stuff is involved in it. It isn't just mundane, stuff. They're involved. And so then it just gets all the more complicated and filled with all kinds of sublime fears, as you religiousize it. Obviously this is the whole point is how did the church end up thinking it had such a role to play and so much to say about marriage? Right, and that's how it got started. Okay. Something that is very much secular and temporal, being thought of as sacred and eternal. All right, let's keep going.
Lucky days were sought out, Thursday being most favorably regarded, and weddings celebrated at the full of the moon were thought to be exceptionally fortunate. It was the custom of many Near Eastern peoples to throw grain upon the newlyweds. This was a magical rite which was supposed to ensure fecundity. Certain Oriental peoples used rice for this purpose.
Well, that one's pretty obvious. But again, you can see the opportunity for one to say, well, okay, so should we just toss out that whole, throwing rice thing? Because it's such a primitive notion. We don't believe in fertility cults and stuff anymore or whatever. But it's like, well, or is there, can you repurpose that act? Can you give it a higher symbolism? Maybe there's something about it that has a deep resonance with our animal origin, biologic nature. So it's it has a pleasantness to do it, and just naturally. So don't immediately say, well, yeah, but that's of the flesh, and we should reject all things of the flesh. They're evil. I shouldn't go with what feels good, quote unquote. See if there's some way that you can make it more than just that, that positive stimulus response thing of an animal origin creature. Maybe there's a way you can get people to reflect leveraging off of that and think about some higher thing. The Catholic Church was always, love to do this. They took every primitive evolutionary notion that they ran into and the people they absorbed into the Catholic Church and repurposed their traditions. Whatever it is, taking the people from the Norse and their Yule traditions, they just, repurpose those things, and give them Christian rationalization schemes, we've done this a lot, and the Revelators are saying don't just because that's been done in kind of unfortunate ways or simplistic or primitive ways, don't throw that out. There's an appropriateness to the evolutionary process. Just think in higher terms. Why Thursday? I don't know. I don't know the magic of the days well enough. I'm sure someone who's familiar with the history of the magic of the 7 days could explain to why Thursday.
Well, it had to be after they were able to figure out days of the week.
Well, no, remember,
too long ago.
No. That was very long. You know, that's the oldest thing there is. The prince's staff started 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And we've been counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, the days of the week, for 500,000 years.
Okay, so that's
500. Right. You know, I mean, when they say Thursday, they don't mean when it came to be called Thursday, you know, named after Thor. Okay. They just mean the fifth day of the week. Somehow, facilitating this thing. I don't know why.
And then if it's at noon, you're
building. We all know that there's other traditions, you know, of Saturday or Sunday or whatnot, you know, these days. But, not to mention, it's like, oh my gosh, no, don't do it on the full moon. You know, that's bad. It's like, there's so many things like that that one time they were thought of as the best of the best, and now they're thought of as the worst of the worst. All these arbitrary notions, you know, flip signs frequently. Why would you get married when everyone turns into a lunatic? Or maybe that's the point. This is lunacy to get married.
Make them reflect.
Fecundity. Just think of fecundity. okay. okay. So let's keep going here.
Fire and water were always considered the best means of resisting ghosts and evil spirits. Hence altar fires and lighted candles, as well as the baptismal sprinkling of holy water, were usually in evidence at weddings. For a long time, it was customary to set a false wedding day and then suddenly postpone the event so as to put the ghosts and spirits off the track.
That's an example of my favorite things about the whole ghost cult thing. On the one hand, humans, we're just infinitely fearful of the machinations of the ghosts and the spirits. Where it seems like the assumption is, they are so incredibly intelligent and clever and all-seeing and whatnot. And then, because they aren't very philosophic, they aren't consistent at all. And in the same breath, they think that they're easily duped like this. So it's hilarious. But it's, you'll see that in a little child as they're developing, and they don't have anywhere near even a rudimentary sort of philosophic context that they live and think in. And so there'll be just very stark juxtapositions of inconsistency. And if they never mature out of that, they're still, when they're 70 years old, you still see that. It's like, wait a minute. In the same sentence, you said two things that are directly contradictory. Did you notice that? No, they didn't notice that. But they do have a job on TV as an opinion person.
And I slept at a
home. that delightful inconsistency of the minds of primitives or the primitive minds of those who are currently alive. Then the obvious stuff. Besides the rice, we've got the whole bit with holy water and candles and whatnot. Again, all these things that we do, that the more you know about the history of them, the more you might want to just throw them out. It's like, well, or maybe they can be repurposed. I want to just keep stressing that's very much the reason why they're telling you all these things. It's not to make you, like I say all the time, it's not to make you a scholar of ancient, traditions or something, or where the current traditions came from. It's so that you can pause and reflect. It's like, well, is there something there, that makes it worthy of keeping, and can I repurpose it in some higher way and give the wedding ceremony a more reflective nature? And I'll just say that, I'll bring it up right now. The whole group thing, one of the very important things about getting married in front of a group is it gets you, you know, it gets the couple, the two members of the couple that are getting married, reflecting. It might be kind of scary, but reflecting about, you know, what a big responsibility they're taking on. You know, they're doing this before everyone. You know, and you know, this isn't just something that's flippant between the two of them. Everyone observing has expectations of you now, and you have to rise to that. It, you know, it's a sobering and reflective inducing phenomenon to do it in front of a group.
They should make that the same for divorce.
Yeah.
There you go.
Then it would be a whole different deal.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's just, yeah. And one of the positive things, yeah, being the public square, yes. But, you know, and one of the positive things, even though we're going to keep stressing about, you know, what's religion doing usurping this, I mean, but it, even though it's not what religion, it isn't the reason why religion poked its nose into this phenomenon, but nonetheless, it does supply an opportunity for the couple to pause and reflect, I'm also doing this before God. All right? You know, and it adds, again, you know, there should be some seriousness to this. Not a false eternalization of it. You know, you're not being married for eternity here. But you know, to recognize that there's this new mode that can allow for eternity to express in time that wasn't there before. Before, your relationship to eternity could come down through you and express in time. Your future spouse, right? Eternity can come down through them and express in time. But you bring the two together, and you have the super additive consequence of the relationship between the two. And now eternity can come down through that third fact. That super additive consequence, that literal relationship between the two, is another mode for eternity to be able to get to time. Right? So it's important to bring that into play. Everything you do is a new opportunity for you to stand in time, stand in eternity and work in time. Either as an individual or as this super additive relationship. Okay, what else do we have here?
The teasing of newlyweds and the pranks played upon honeymooners are all relics of those far distant days when it was thought best to appear miserable and ill at ease in the sight of the spirits so as to avoid arousing their envy. The wearing of the bridal veil is a relic of the times when it was considered necessary to disguise the bride so that ghosts might not recognize her, and also to hide her beauty from the gaze of the otherwise jealous and envious spirits. The bride's feet must never touch the ground just prior to the ceremony. Even in the 20th century, it is still the custom under the Christian mores to stretch carpets from the carriage landing to the church altar.
Hang on, Walt. Okay, what, why? Okay, wait, you might be going, I mean, I don't get it. What's the deal with the carpet and, you know, and that her feet must never touch the ground? Again, you have the old simplistic dichotomy of heaven and earth, okay, paralleled with good and bad, all right? I mean, you know, you're so existentializing, aggrandizing this thing, believing that it's of heaven and not of earth, that you can't let it be polluted by her feet literally touching the earth, right? The dirt. You know, this is a magic carpet, you know, bounding you away from the evils of the earth, you know, so that this is of eternity, you know, all the more. You know, again, you can go, well, good grief, talk about superstitious and silly. But, you know, again, the whole paragraph is what we've been talking about. Okay, should we toss that out, or is it, you know, should we keep that going and think of it in a better way, or what?
Well, also, too, it was, what you referred to earlier, it's Jesus said, the world is not your enemy.
Yeah.
And the dirt is not, I mean, the I am on page 6 of the foreword, from the fetters, from the feet of unqualified infinity to the head of deity liberation.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, that's, you know, doing the whole gamut. And that's right. Where you get the strength and the power and the grace, too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. See, if anything, what we probably should be fostering, you know, in that ceremony is more definitively that on the one hand, you have spirit in the inner life and you are bringing it into direct engagement with matter in the outer life, and you're going to bring the two together and get a super additive consequence of a cosmic phenomenon. So rather than trying to bound the spiritual away from, you know, the material, you know, we probably should be encouraging bringing material consciousness and spiritual consciousness, material pragmatism and spiritual idealism together in a super additive consequence, all the more through this modality of marriage, right, to be a means for greater cosmic consciousness and the harmony of the cosmos to shine forth into the world, to bring that which is above down to that which is below, right? To foster the evolution of this world towards light and life, a synchronization with the already divine harmony of supremacy. Okay.
Jesus also said in one of his revised prayers, maybe it was the midwares, uh-huh. I can't remember which.
Yeah.
Save us in temptation. Mm-hmm. We already know we're going to be tempted by the world. Save us in temptation. In other words, I think it was Bill Sadler Jr. that said, I bring my thought adjuster with me wherever I go. Now, he may have right. overused that.
But
just that concept, it stayed with me.
Yeah.
Bring God with me in this temptation. I mean, sometimes it's just overwhelming.
Right.
I got to get my sense here.
Right. Don't think in dichotomies, you know, so intensely that you literally, you know, make yourself schizophrenic,
yeah.
Right? That you cut yourself in two, you know, because of how much you set matter and spirit at odds to one another. Right? It's a very unfortunate thing that humans have long done. Right. The Isle of Paradise is not the enemy of the eternal sun, or vice versa. Right. The absolute spirit of the body of the sun and the absolute matter of the substance of the isle are in no way antithetical. Okay. Right. They're antipodal, right? They establish the endpoints of an infinite differential of potential for a super additive consequence of the relationship between the two. Right? Each is just as indispensable to the super additive consequence. You know, there's nothing without both. So yeah, see, so just right there, as you reflect on why they're doing that, how they're trying to separate heaven and earth with a carpet, right, lest they touch. So you see how fundamentally false that is in the big picture. You know, you are trying to bring the two together instead of demonizing the one against, you know, against the other. Okay.
One of the most ancient forms of the wedding ceremony was to have a priest bless the wedding bed to ensure the fertility of the union. This was done long before any formal wedding ritual was established. During this period in the evolution of the marriage mores, the wedding guests were expected to file through the bedchamber at night, thus constituting legal witness to the consummation of marriage.
I told you we'd get to that here in a little bit, John. Yeah, so there. Okay. But at least they aren't participating like they were before in the bridal exhibition hall. Okay, see, so we've made an improvement. They're just filing through, and it's all for a very pragmatic reason, right? Just, you know, someone's got to witness this so that they can testify if anyone questions. Notice again how they're reminding you. As I was saying at the very, when we very first started, we're thinking about in this second paper, in contrast to the first paper, and in this series of three papers, we're thinking about how you set up, elements of the mores system about marriage that aren't purely tied to just the biologic fact of mating, right? That go beyond just the mere mating aspect of marriage. But early on, like they said, really the whole point is just the mating. So this was done long before any formal wedding ritual or any formal, wedding ritual was established, like they said there. Because you're just not there's no elaboration yet. It's all very matter of fact. And so just, and you've probably even seen that done in TV shows or movies, back during the Middle Ages, having a priest come in and, and bless the bed before the wedding couple retires from the big party they're having out in the hall. In not that distant times, this was still a very key element. But it wasn't the only element. There was a whole rigmarole of a fancy ceremony that went on, too, and stuff. You can see the potential, just when you talk about things like that, that when we were talking about the heaven and earth separation and stuff, on the one hand, all of this falderall that we imaginatively develop is kind of completely arbitrary. But, that's if you just look at it factually. If you look at it more truthfully, it's at least trying to bring in elements of the phenomenon that aren't just very basal biologic matter-of-fact things. See, it isn't, these falderall things, these fancy things aren't literally spiritual, but they're the beginnings of not merely material, right? So there's a truth there. Just as I pointed out, humans have never gotten to a three-element philosophy yet. Right? At best, they have two elements, body and mind, matter and mind. And these days, it's gone back to just philosophical materialism. This is one element. Okay, they've never gotten to three. But there's a potential. If you go to two, if you get body and mind, the mind is not spirit, but at least it's not matter. Like spirit is not matter. So, you're on the road to eventually abstracting spirit from mind and recognizing its independent existence, because you've gotten to not matter, even if you haven't gotten to spirit. So that's a general phenomenon that's in play, where you can see the evolutionary process. There's a truth in it long before there's any proper fact to it. As it leaves behind the basic fact where it started, hasn't gotten to its destiny yet. Okay, but at least it's not merely the beginning. It's the beginning plus a potential to eventually get to an ending. Yeah. It's a beginning and a not beginning. let's see, did we get everything else there? Lots and lots of ensuring of fertility going on here. Because, again, for those who weren't here when I stressed this extensively at the very beginning, of this block of papers, I guess at the beginning of this paper as well, I re-emphasized it. Remember, in the book, marriage is a word that only applies to a procreating union, right? The book isn't addressing other types of unions. Male-male, female-female, male-female, not procreating. It's not addressing any of those. Right? Marriage is just about, right, as it was historically, it's just about a procreating couple.
That's why the society has an interest in it. It's
right,
future of that society.
Right, and that's why marriage and family, that kind of marriage and family, the resultant family, right, that's the foundation of all of human civilization. Yeah. It's not that non-procreating unions don't have a role in stuff. It's just, right, it should be obvious that there's all of those other things are pointless if the current generation is the last group of people on the planet. And there's no way of fostering a stable next generation. Right? There's no context for children, stable context for children to be born into, so that you can pass what you've learned to the next generation, etc. Right? I mean, obviously, this is a very key element, that procreating union. Remember, fundamentally, the emergency is a civilizational emergency, not an individual emergency. It's a collective emergency. So the book is mostly talking about civilizational issues, not individual issues. And that's why marriage is being defined and used like that in the book. That's the key point of the fifth epical revelation, to address the civilizational, the philosophical emergency. The philosophy of civilization is predicated on the philosophy of the family. Your basic individual integrity and stability was taken care of 2,000 years ago. Right? That's not a pressing issue anymore. But civilization is. If you were sitting here without an adjuster and a far cry from a third circler, okay, that's a pressing issue. Okay, you have no soul, dude. Okay? And you're not getting to any next life. Okay, but that's not in play anymore. Right? It's just not a pressing issue. The thing that religions are all worried about, salvation, that's not a pressing issue. Right? But a potential interregnum of civilization, that is a pressing issue. Okay.
The luck element, that in spite of all premarital tests, certain marriages turned out bad, led primitive man to seek insurance protection against marriage failure, led him to go in quest of priests and magic. And this movement culminated directly in modern church weddings. But for a long time, marriage was generally recognized as consisting in the decisions of the contracting parents, later of the pair. Well, for the last 500 years, church and state have assumed jurisdiction and now presume to make pronouncements of marriage.
Yeah, notice at the end, it's not just that they've assumed jurisdiction, they've presumed, right? Yeah. They presume to make pronouncements about marriage left and right anymore. And that is a relatively recent phenomenon. I suppose we could think for a second about that. I mean, why is that such a recent phenomenon? That you have this ismizing both from church and state going on relative to marriage and weddings and stuff. Remember what happened in the 6 centuries prior to the beginning of the 20th century. You know, prior to writing here, you know, the Revelation. Immediately before you had 3 centuries of the Enlightenment, and before that you had 3 centuries of the Renaissance. Okay, once mankind is born again, right, the Renaissance, in other words, once mankind pulls himself out of the darkness and begins to function in a collective way more as humans rather than fancy animals, you have, you know, an awakening of your, you know, when you awaken to your humanity, you awaken to your by grace relationship to eternity and all of the notions that you have about the existential and the absolute and the eternal and stuff. Right? So that starts to swirl about in your mind. You know, and that's what leads to all of this ismizing. See, because you're spiritual, you're falsely spiritualizing everything. You're ismizing everything. So that's why it has that kind of time scale. And just one other little thing about all these insurance policies and all this sort of stuff. You know, what is marriage failure? See, it's all this. You seek insurance protection against marriage failure. Is that marriage failure? Man, you know, Bob and Betty just don't get along. You know, neither of them, you know, like, you know, the hobbies of the other or whatever. No. Okay, marriage failure is no kids, right? That's all marriage is about, is kids, okay?
You think that's being questioned?
Right. Okay, so, right, for those in the past, they didn't have all these fanciful romantic notions and whatnot, right? It was all very matter of fact, and it was all about kids, right? If for some reason there's no kids, that's a marriage failure. And they're trying to figure out, you know, if they didn't, you know, wear the correct charm to ward off the spirit machinations, you know, and they've messed up. You know, did some witch cast a spell so that you're not fertile anymore? You know, what's going on here? Right? I mean, that's what they're trying to figure out and trying to prevent. Okay.
Life went bad.
Yes, it was bad grain, you know, it wasn't fertile grain, whatever. Okay, let's go on to the next subject here.
5, plural marriages. In the early history of marriage, the unmarried women belonged to the men of the tribe. Later on, a woman had only one husband at a time. This practice of one man at a time was the first step away from the promiscuity of the herd. While a woman was allowed but one man, her husband could sever such temporary relationships at will. But these loosely regulated associations were the first step toward living pairwise, in distinction to living herdwise. In this stage of marriage development, children usually belong to the mother.
For obvious reasons. she's the only constant or even... identifiable element in, you know, in play. Okay, so you can already see from this first paragraph what we're on the journey towards here now. From horde mentality moray system to eventually true monogamy. And remember, you know, that's coming up. You know, we won't get to that next section here tonight, but that's the second of the 4 indispensables, you know, that we're looking for here now. You know, those 4 indispensables to the progress of advancing civilization. The second half, you know, in contrast to the 4 indispensables for the progress of early civilization: slavery, war, social classes, profit motive. You know, we got true religion a while back. Remember, they brought in true religion. We're about to get true monogamy. There's an evolution here, both in terms of doing what, going from what is very natural, that animal origin horde phenomenon, you know, towards the extreme unnaturalness of true monogamy. But over a long span of time, eventually when you get to light and life, remember the biology is being biologically engineered forward so that way down the road, true monogamy is natural, predicated on that advanced genetics. But as you'll see, and they start talking about this, there's, you know, and I think everyone understands there's nothing at all natural right now about even monogamy, let alone true monogamy. You know, and we struggle, you know, when we get a little more imaginative to not drop right back to the horde. Oh yeah, this dawning of the sixth agent in the collective in the middle of the 20th century. So everyone is kind of naturally a little bit more of an animated, spiritualized mind. Did we go forward? No, everyone started talking about the free love of the horde again, and thinking that was very progressive-minded. Right? It's like, no, no, that's the very beginning, right? Yeah.
Yeah, but wasn't so
Danny and Woodstock. Yes, we all know the stories, okay? But remember, we already got the rank savagery thing about free love, right? Yeah, so they're just reminding, you know, that's the evolutionary process. You know, you got to know what's most primitive, horde's most primitive, true monogamy is the most advanced, you know, and you're somewhere in between, hopefully, moving in the correct direction. You can't expect now to be perfect, but you can challenge it to be perfecting, moving, in this instance, moving towards true monogamy. Let's see here. Anything else there? Just, you know, we see it again. We talked about this. Remember that I keep saying horde, you know, but you notice they keep saying herd just to remind you of, you know, of we have such a biologic predicate in play here with the mere mating fact. And that's, you know, back when we were talking about the horde, it was, you know, relative to civilization. You know, but here, again, they keep reminding you, you've got just the basic animal thing of mating. That is, you know, the origin, if you will, of this whole phenomenon you're talking about. So, you know, it's very much, you know, not merely horde, but herd, you know, that's in play here when you're talking about marriage. Okay.
The next step in mating evolution was the group marriage. This communal phase of marriage had to intervene in the unfolding of family life because the marriage mores were not yet strong enough to make pair associations permanent. The brother and sister marriages belonged to this group. Five brothers of one family would marry five sisters of another. All over the world, looser forms of communal marriage gradually evolved into various types of group marriage. And these group associations were largely regulated by the totem mores. Family life slowly and surely developed because sex and marriage regulation favored the survival of the tribe itself by ensuring the survival of larger numbers of children.
All right, so again, reminding you how early we are in this, where this social evolution is kind of pretty much like a lot of the biologic evolution, survival of the fittest. You know, is ruling the day to a great degree here. You know, and so no one is adopting these more advanced things because they have some far-seeing idealistic mind. They're just rattling around kind of at arbitrary mores, and the unfortunate more selections die off because they're more vulnerable. Right, because we have the nutrition epoch and the security age issues in play very early on. It's a harsh phenomenon, and little bits of unfortunateness in the more system you select, you know, makes it so that you don't handle, you know, issues of hunger and issues of security as well. Yeah. And so over time, those that just stumbled upon a more progressive mores system progressed. The others ceased to be. And it was only way down the road that someone reflected back and go, oh, you know, now I understand why, you know, in ancient times those other peoples died off. I see that wasn't the smartest way to handle, you know, marriage and family. Right? And so they began to actually understand why they had the mores they had. And then we began to forget. You know, when we get to the 20th century, and we look at the mores and go, I don't know why we have these things. They seem to be completely arbitrary. Let's just throw them out. You know, and so then we've got the mess we've got right now. But there was, you go back a ways, and even though the people weren't as sophisticated in their thinking in some ways, at least they had some recognition of why it was important to keep doing what they were doing, because they know experientially others had tried other ways and they didn't fare so well. But we've forgotten that whole experiential testing of other methods, right? okay, let's see what else we have there. You notice they just keep stressing that seems kind of primitive. Your first thought is, yeah, but it's a step forward, right? Enslaving them was a step forward from eating them. Right? Is that, like we always say, you got those basic things. Neither are very profound, but moving in the correct direction. Right, so you've got these. And notice how Adam and Eve could step in, you know, on the fact that they're mating brother-sister. That would actually fit in to this group marriage. So you can kind of see how maybe an Adam and Eve would be timed with the evolution of marriage. They would kind of fit right into the group marriage state. See, not, you know, and since that was the easiest kind of way to do the group marriage, it was brothers marrying sisters. We talked about how there's, you know, rough parallel between developmental epics and planetary mortal epics, you know, dispensations. So, all right, let's see here. Anything else there? They mentioned the totem mores. Reminding you of that's one of the key grouping modalities that people had, you know, we're all the same totem, you know, so we're going to marry within the totem. That's a way of, you know, of thinking in group marriage beyond, you know, modes like brother-sister, say. I think they mentioned already, you know, eventually you start thinking, instead of, I have to marry within my totem, oh, no, I can't marry within my totem. You know, it flips 180 degrees eventually, you know, as you more and more favor, you know, exogamy, you know, marriage without rather than marriage within. Remember we talked about that? But at this mode, it's, you know, you've got those these marriage within group modes in play. All right?
Group marriages gradually gave way before the emerging practices of polygamy, polygyny and polyandry, mm-hmm. among the more advanced tribes. But polyandry was never general, being usually limited to queens and rich women. Furthermore, it was customarily a family affair, one wife for several brothers. Caste and economic restrictions sometimes made it necessary for several men to content themselves with one wife. Even then, the woman would marry only one, the others being loosely tolerated as uncles of the joint progeny.
Okay, so I just mentioned, you know, we had those technical terms of endogamy and exogamy. Now, remember the gammy, you know, part means marriage. You know, that was marriage within and marriage without. you know, polygamy, polygamy, right? Okay, that's just multiple marriage, in contrast to single marriage, monogamy. And then polygyny and polyandry, right? You know, like you know, the G-Y-N-Y part of polygyny there, like gyno, right? Woman, right? Poly, polygyny, you know, that's many women, and polyandry is many men, you know, just literally. Okay. Okay, and then pointing out that I think, as everyone knows, polyandry is a, you know, a minor phenomenon. Obviously, the main, you know, matter of fact, a lot of times when someone says polygamy, you just, you know, it's assumed to mean polygyny, right? That there's multiple women. But technically, it doesn't, you know, imply multiple women. It could be either one. Okay, and then let's see what else we have there. Yeah, remember how we, you know, when they say caste and economic restrictions sometimes made it necessary. Remember we touched upon that back when in section 3 when we did purchase and dowry. Those issues of how society will set up various mores where you know you can make it economically very difficult, or even infeasible, for people to meet the expectations of the society. And so, you know, the mating instinct is pretty strong. And so, you know, something's going to give, right? I mean, there are going to, you're going to invariably drive things into modalities that that deal with these restrictions. So, you know, one has to, you know, I think everyone knows that. You pass a law and there's always unintended consequences to a law. It's like, oh, I didn't think about how the fact that that has an indirect forcing on this other issue, and, you know, and that drives things into a state that I don't necessarily want. It's always very difficult because everything is a system. You start focusing very intensely on one part and not thinking in systemic terms, and you drive other things astray. So they're, you know, they're just reminding you of that fact. And you'll see that comes back around, that they want you to reflect on that. I think it's when we get to the next section about monogamy that comes back around again. The complexity of society needs to be considered. You can't think in simplistic ideological terms about society. It's a very complex or organic phenomenon. But that doesn't stop everyone from trying to do it. You know, we all know that's a, again, that's one of the reasons why the book is in my lap, because everyone is thinking in such absolutist, simplistic, ideological terms about everything. Everything's an ism, and it's absolute. And everything outside of that is absolutely evil, right? So it's, you know, it's becoming just hopeless for us to, you know, to have anything even remotely approaching equity, you know, in a system. All right, keep going here.
The Jewish custom requiring that a man consort with his deceased brother's widow for the purpose of raising up seed for his brother was the custom of more than half the ancient world. This was a relic of the time when marriage was a family affair rather than an individual association.
I see. Notice they just throw that in as a little companion to the previous paragraph. You know, when you had that family affair, one wife for several brothers. Yeah. So, yeah. When you see that in the Old Testament, you know, and if you're not familiar with the Old Testament and you stumble upon that, you may be very startled by that. You know, the raising up seed for his brother, you know, concept. You know, they're just trying to remind you. No, don't judge it from your current moray system. You know, go back. It's just a totally acceptable thing in that more group modality. Again, because remember, there's almost no romantic notions or anything in play. This is all very pragmatic phenomenon. No one has, you know, they'll stress that in a minute. No one has, you know, has all of these intense emotions about this that we do now, which are all, you know, none of which are natural, all of which are just we impose upon ourselves, you know, having this intensity of notions about relationships between men and women. Okay, keep going. Yep, or you got some? Yep.
Yeah, I keep thinking about, and you already covered this in paper 77, but just, what did it feel like to Adamson when Radha had but one thought? I mean, it took him a little while to get around to it, but he must have felt something right off. And, it,
yeah.
I don't know, it's just,
yeah, I think it actually sank it even says that he did. But he was still working. You know, remember at the beginning when they start that conversation, they remind you about his whole family that left him, right, and went off to Adentia.
Was still in sorrow.
Right. So you know he had a whole process he was working through there still. But he got over it. I think they had a couple kids. Yes. 67 to be exact.
You know, a lot of people have, I don't know. You know, my mom and dad grew up in the era where, especially my mom, you just did your duty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and cranked out kids.
Yep. And you just, that's what you did.
Yeah.
If you had any notions, you were trying to get to 12 because that was important. Yeah, you know, we're just about to read about that. It's important that you bring that up because they're about to give us a little sense about how humans have struggled with some of these issues of wanting lots of kids for a number of reasons, but a few women are Radha. Few women can have 67 kids, still be going strong, or Eve. Right, and have them by the dozens. As you're about to point out, every woman in this room knows, right? Even if you haven't had kids of your own, indirectly how taxing this is in so many ways.
In our environment,
right? And so, these facts have been part of the evolution as we're just about to read. We set up a system to deal with it at a certain point, and like they've mentioned, invariably there's relics of some of those things that go forward in time. Religions might reimagine them, right? Re-rationalize them in some way, but they're still ongoing, right? It's a very complex evolutionary process that invariably... is not going to satisfy our most enlightened idealistic eye, when you think about what your mother went through, say.
Sure.
Right? Yeah.
Because that's looking backwards.
Yeah.
Looking forwards, there is an idealism, I think, with the younger generation they're not necessarily going to accept mores of their parents or grandparents,
Right.
And yeah. I think things are kind of on an exponential curve here, and I think that we shouldn't throw away, we should be like Jesus did with the people, you can temper those ideals, but don't just,
don't be revolutionary about them. Don't think in, think in evolutionary terms. Don't think in God the Mother terms. Don't think in false fiat God the Father terms.
Right. We can bring together this the dual thing of the earthy thing of the having children, but also too the ideals of. Kind of like Adamson and Rob.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what you're bringing up is just, obviously when you reflect on what we're reading right now, it leads you to the next section, you know.
Yeah.
It's building to the, you know, the discourse in the next section that really speaks to these ideals and the challenges of you know, relating our evolutionary facts to those ideals and how complex and difficult that is. All right, here, let's keep going.
The institution of polygyny recognized at various times four sorts of wives. One, the ceremonial or legal wives. Two, wives of affection and permission. Three, concubines, contractual wives. Four, slave wives.
Okay, so just starting with that basic little fact, I think probably everyone is familiar with those from, you know, stories or movies, you know, if nothing else, give you a sense of the history of these things. You know, notice how they're adding a little bit of clarification, right? That you have this issue of ceremonial or legal wise. So you have the part of the polygyny phenomenon that is most existentialized, you know, most aggrandized, you know, and taken very, very seriously. You know, and then, you know, other stuff, okay, in contrast to that kind of nucleus fact. But you notice it's not just wives of affection, it's wives of affection and permission. So you know, they're just, you know, you can figure out what those permissions, what that permission might be, you know, referring to. And there's, you know, and it refers to many different things, but you know, if nothing, it refers to item number one, giving permission. But you know, society is going to have dictates about this and whatnot. I mean, there's going to be various ways that you have to have permission, you know, to, whatever the mores system is about this. But again, you know, they're reminding you that, especially in earlier times, you know, again, there's basically none of this sweetheart thing, like they're about to point out, going on. There's not, you know, the romantic note. I mean, it's all very pragmatic, you know, in general. Okay, so.
Does that relate to evolution, what they say about evolution? It's not versus revelation.
Yeah.
It's just.
Right. Yeah. And so you have, on the one hand, you have permission, and on the other hand, with concubines, you have contracts, right? Even kind of more concrete. Okay. So that's the, you know, the complexity of the polygyny phenomenon. And notice that, you know, the institution of polygyny. Okay, this isn't just some rogue thing or no. I mean, this is the official institutionalized phenomenon we're talking about here. And so again, like, you know, the contracts and permission and everything, it's a very, very structured phenomenon. You know, with not one hint of what we call immorality. You know, i.e., non-conformity to taboos or something. Right, going on. It's all above boards. Okay.
True polygyny, where all the wives are of equal status and all the children equal, has been very rare. Usually, even with plural marriages, the home was dominated by the head wife, the status companion. She alone had the ritual wedding ceremony, and only the children of such a purchased or dowered spouse could inherit, unless by special arrangement with the status wife.
Yeah, so we see Number one on the list is playing a key role here, like we were guessing. Okay, most of that's pretty straightforward, but the thing that should really strike you is the first word of the paragraph, true. Okay, as we started talking about polygyny, in other words, polygamy, was that the first word that popped into your head? Oh yeah, truth. Conformity with the cosmos in the highest sense. Probably not. You were probably looking down your nose condescendingly at this notion. It's like, you know, primitives and, you know, polygamy. But they throw it right in your face. true polygyny. Okay, so what's the deal there? It's important that we figure it out here, because we're about to get to, you know, next time when we start with the next section, it starts out with true monogamy. Okay, there's that true word again. We need to figure out what this true word, you know, adjective means here. How do we understand this as being somehow, you know, conformal with the wholeness of the cosmos? The word true, not to mention living and dynamic. Okay? The key is, if you know, it's there in that's in the sentence. If you reflect on the sentence, you can figure it out. You keep reading. Where all the wives are of equal status, and all the children equal. Equals what kind of a word? A spirit word, right? Right. Remember again, you know, it's equal means equity, like the al suffix of equal means like, right? And the root, you know, is what you mean by genuine equity, not what the dictionary says, but genuine cosmic harmony equity, right? And equal is referring to what's equity like. In other words, these, you know, the spiritual essence, the unity essence of the equity. Right? True polygyny, see, is predicated on spiritual equality. That's how it can be true. Right? But, you know, you've got whatever physical and mental aspects. But if you have genuine third element spiritual and the genuine equality of spiritual in play, that essence of the harmony, of the equity, right, brings into play conformity with the triunity, truth. That's what the deal is with that. They're trying to get you to think, see, about the physics of the cosmos, you know, and how they're using the word true. Right? You know, because your first thought is, whoa, I think that's a blooper. Whoever wrote this paper, I think they meant to say genuine or something, didn't they? Maybe they didn't. They meant to say true, because, you know, so you already know the answer. Oh, when you start talking about monogamy, for it to be true monogamy and not just merely factual monogamy, like mallard ducks, right? How do you get to true monogamy? Right? Ducks can't do it. They don't have a spiritual nature that can be engaged one-to-one as an equality of engagement.
Even if they're in a row?
Not even if they're super uniform. Yeah. Now, it's not that poor man's unity. It's not uniformity. Right? Genuine unity. Yeah. So that's what this is again related to, remember, outside of the central universe, the definition of goodness is an evolutionary definition, not an existential definition. Only in the central universe does, you know, and related to the eternal, the existential, does goodness mean perfectness? Or is goodness predicated on perfectness? Right? Out here, in an evolutionary temporal domain, goodness is perfectingness, right? In conformity with that that evolving cosmos, truth, see, it doesn't have to be, you know, the truths of existential eternity. It can be the truths of experiential eternity. Right? This is about the truths of experiential eternity. Right? It's conformity with that evolutionary system. You know, even though it's not a settled status of the grand universe, settled in light and life more system, it still can be true. It's that truth that has a relationship to the facts of time. Not that truth that doesn't. Not that truth in truth, beauty, goodness. Right? It's not that, existential beauty truth goodness triplet. It's the experiential fact truth goodness triplet we're talking about here. And you're, you know, if you're only fixating on truth, beauty, goodness, even if you don't recognize that you're fixating existentially when you do that, you are. See, you're going to be very befuddled by them saying true polygyny. That's going to... Right.
Strip your gears.
Please. You're going to go, I found an error in the book. No, you found an error in your frame of reference, in your mind, is what you found. Right? You've made a false assumption somewhere. What is it? Okay, so that's the cool thing about that paragraph, is that it starts with true polygyny. Anything else there? Oh yeah, we already mentioned about the head wife. And all of the complications that we've seen in movies and stuff and stories about that dynamics, you know, everyone knows about the dynamics of that in history. Usually it's part of the court intrigue, you know, in the story, because you're talking about, you know, kings and queens and whatnot, and the doings of the court. Okay.
The status wife was not necessarily the love wife. In early times, she usually was not. The love wife, or sweetheart, did not appear until the races were considerably advanced, more particularly after the blending of the evolutionary tribes with the Nodites and Adamites.
See, I told you it was coming. That's, without that biologic uplift, there is not the imaginative ability, right, to go there, to get to the notion of sweetheart. It just basically isn't there. Right. Now, and again, I'll just remind you, you know, with, you know, pure Andonites, right, they couldn't even think abstractly enough to wrap their minds around grandchildren. Okay, they're not going to get to sweethearts. Okay, they can't even get to grandchildren as a concept. Okay, so, right, it's all very matter of fact. And it's just very difficult for us to even imagine this, to think about this, to put yourself in that frame of mind where you think about marriage, you know, especially when there's multiple wives in play, you know, just completely matter-of-factly with no jealousy in play or anything, just nothing like that. You know, and he, well, that's the way they always play it in the movies, you know, there's the jealousy thing amongst, see, that's false. That's false story writing. It wasn't like that. Okay? I mean, this whole bit they're talking about here with the dominating the head wife and stuff, I mean, you know, that's not based upon these notions of jealousy or anything like that.
I read a book one time that told about the first Europeans who discovered the Ugandan tribes.
Uh-huh.
And there was jealousy, but it was not if their wife had a sexual liaison.
Right.
It was if she went down and started working. That was her work that he was jealous about.
Yeah. Yeah. Which just reminds you, as humans began to bring in the notion of jealousy, it had all sorts of different modalities. Again, because there's nothing natural to it, because it's not biologic at all. So obviously, when you introduce jealousy, I mean, who knows what it's going to be, what notions are going to be attached to it. Just about anything is possible, since you're just kind of pulling it out of thin air. But just kind of remind, you know, we've already kind of seen the essence of it here. You know, what drives the intensity of something like jealousy, if it's not biology? It's some false existentialization, sacredization, you know, whatnot of an issue. That's what, yeah. You know, that's what gets our, you know, we get our sixth adjective, you know, in there, our energy of zeal in there, and you know, that religious impulse falsely directed, you know, and there's, you know, there's no no numbers big enough on the volume knob to describe how far you can twist a knob, right?
Same thing true for betrayal.
Yeah, right. All those sorts of things, you know, that bring in, you know, a recognition of a disruption relative to unity. We get very intense about those things, even if the disruption from unity is imagined and not genuine. We get very intense because of our sixth adjutant about such things. You know, a violation of purity in some way. Very intense response that we have because of the sixth adjutant to that, that energy of zeal. You know, even if the notion of purity is just completely superstitious and primitive and ridiculous, not to the person who believes it. You know, they believe it is the purity, you know, the fact, the most important thing that anyone can consider, right? And requires only the strongest of response.
And his name is eschewed throughout all years. There's something there.
Yeah, right. It's just, you know, recognize it. You know, that sixth adjutant energy that an animal doesn't have, that zeal, right? That's what powers all of this intensity. Okay, now I lost my place. Where were we? Let's see. Oh, yeah, that's right. The nonites and atomites, yeah. So, okay. Okay, we talked about, I think we got everything. Let's keep going.
The taboo wife, one wife of legal status, created the concubine mores. Under these mores, a man might have only one wife, but he could maintain sex relations with any number of concubines. Concubinage was the stepping stone to monogamy, the first move away from frank polygyny. The concubines of the Jews, Romans, and Chinese were very frequently the handmaidens of the wife. Later on, as among the Jews, the legal wife was looked upon as the mother of all children born to the husband.
Yeah. You know, one could talk endlessly about some of these little historical tidbits, but that term handmaiden, you know, thinking in very practical terms, like I've been stressing you should be thinking, you know, instead of, oh, I'm jealous of all of them. It's like, no, they're really handy to have around, right? I mean, there's lots of diapers to be changed and, you know, or whatnot. You know, lots of floors to be cleaned. You know, lots of gardens to be hoed. You know, whatever it is, all the, you know, the duties that are heaped upon the women in that culture. So, you know, just the fact that there's, not only are they inclined to think practically rather than falsely idealistically about these things, not only that, but just experientially, if you had some tendency to kind of fly off on an inappropriate imaginative tangent, you get this quick positive reinforcement. You know, now that I think about it, this is like really handy. I don't have any issue at all with this, right? And that's one of the reasons why it was so enduring that these traditions went on. It's just experientially, it was just, you get such a positive feedback by having multiple hands, you know, for all of the tasks, if nothing else. All right. And again, you notice they keep stressing the... there's this inexorable influence applied to mankind that's evolving us forward, and don't judge the book by its cover, right? I mean, if you look at any stage, you know, in some hyper-idealistic fashion, it's like, well, this isn't even remotely perfect. This has got this problem and that problem and yada, yada. You know, you're not looking at it truthfully when you do that. See how all these things are a means to a greater end. And so... in their own relative way, divinity flows through them. They aren't, you know, directly divine, there's a divine potential in everything. And so, if you stop looking at it temporally, where there's a difference between potential and actual, right? now is a divine dispensation. Right? Whatever now is, no matter how primitive, no matter how much it's bogged down in the tyranny and gluttony and whatnot and greed and whatnot of the material comfort era. It doesn't change the fact that it has infinite divine potential threaded through it. Right? The supreme mind can take any finite set of facts and give them to supremacy. That's not because the supreme mind is magical. The supreme mind is just actualizing the potentials that are there. You know, it always can see the potential. No matter what the fact is, it always has a potential embedded within it to be taken to supremacy. So he's not doing anything magical. It's just right there in front of the supreme mind. It grabs the potential and sees to its actualization and takes it to supremacy.
Jesus, constantly did that.
Yeah.
He didn't give up on his ideals.
Yeah, I mean, I've brought that out, on Symmetry of Soul recently as we're going through that arc of papers and the Jesus papers. I mean, that's the thing, where you can really bring the story of Jesus alive is when you can see how, he has all these grand plans to begin with, and they all fall flat on their face when they meet the facts of the evolutionary phenomenon. It's like, okay, so that's not going to work. Let's try plan B, and then plan C, and then plan D. Finally, he's on plan triple Z, and he finds something that works. You gotta adapt. I mean, the grand universe is a lot bigger than the plans of Jesus of Nazareth, okay? And he has to adapt. Even post-baptism where you've got Michael, okay, it's just a creator son. Grand universe is a lot bigger than one creator son, right? It's a much bigger scheme, right? It's not going to work out like you envision. That's why you're given a mind, so that you can adapt, And that's the glory of his life. That he didn't give up, no matter how many times, his plans were thwarted. He just went, right, to plan triple Y and then plan triple Z, and right, he just kept going until he found something that worked.
Right? Well, maybe you could think of it too as, the father was his ideals, communing with his father. But then getting out in the world...
The evolutionary world is a different matter. The existential father.
Two aspects of God. Yeah. Right?
Yes, exactly.
Eric was just reminding me. What was that quote, Eric?
The meaning of life is adaptability.
Yes.
Values progress.
No, progressibility. Right. See,
that goes right into what you were just saying.
Right, that's right. I mean, if we want to get to the physics of it, right, the potential... for adaptation is in mind, and meaning is tied to the associative element to mind. Meaning of life is adaptability. Right? You take that potential of adaptability in mind, it's applied downward to living matter as adapting life. Now, in spirit, there's a potential of progressibility. Value of life is its progressibility. Value is a property of spirit substance. Okay, you take that potential of progressibility, you apply it down on the mind, and you have a progressing mind. Right? You actualize that potential of progressibility as progressing mind. Then there's one notch up. Right? So if you have the meaning of life is adaptability, the value of life is its progressibility, what's the purpose of life?
Growth.
It's perfectibility. Right, that comes from your personality. Right, and so you apply that that personality spirit pattern. Right, so it applies to the spirit substance below it, and gives you perfecting spirit. The shorthand word for perfecting spirit is growth. Right, and because growth is up there in spirit energy, not down in mind energy, that's why you're not conscious of growth. right? Because your conscience is down in the mind, you know. So, yeah, anyway, a little side there. But yes, that, like I said, why are we given a mind? So that you can adapt, right? Because it has the potential of adaptability in it, right? And the living matter has it can be varied, right? So you can engage it.
Even the Creator Son has to be adaptable.
Yeah, everyone. That's why a Creator Son has a mind. You know, I mean, if he didn't have to adapt, he would be just a fancy machine. But he's not. He's a minded being because he's got to adapt. It doesn't matter if he's a creator being. He still has to adapt.
He has rebellion. He's
got to adapt. Whatever. He's got to adapt. Everything has to adapt. Right, because there's always something bigger that you have to conform to. You know, no part is the whole. Even if the part is an infinite part, like the Universal Father, he's still minded because he has to adapt, because there's a lot of things a lot bigger than the Father. Yeah, so right, that's why we're minded. Okay, let's keep going here.
The olden taboos on sex relations with a pregnant or nursing wife tended greatly to foster polygyny. Primitive women aged very early because of frequent childbearing coupled with hard work. Such overburdened wives only managed to exist by virtue of the fact that they were put in isolation 1 week out of each month when they were not heavy with child. Such a wife often grew tired of bearing children and would request her husband to take a second and younger wife, one able to help with both childbearing and the domestic work. The new wives were therefore usually hailed with delight by the older spouses. There existed nothing on the order of sex jealousy.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've already, you know, all of the practical things that you see them pointing out there, you know, and then they punctuate it with that last line. See, there existed nothing on the order, you know, even on the order of sex jealousy. You know, no jealousy, not even anything close to jealousy. I mean, that whole domain just is nothing to do with it. See? So can you think about that? Like I said, a lot of story writers can't. A lot of story writers impose jealousy back on those old stories. And it was not there. Okay, so, you know, and, you know, that little parenthetical, that's another one of those. Oh, how horrible. They lock them up for, you know, for a month while she's menstruating, you know, because she's totally unclean, and, you know, you can't even see her, let alone, you know, touch her or touch anything she touches, you know. Ah, but she's thinking, woohoo, I got a week vacation. Yeah, so the way this all works out, and the grand conspiracy that is the evolutionary process.
Maybe she's
your
girlfriend.
All right, let's keep going.
The number of wives was only limited by the ability of the man to provide for them. Wealthy and able men wanted large numbers of children, and since the infant mortality was very high, it required an assembly of wives to recruit a large family. Many of these plural wives were mere laborers, slave wives.
All right, so again, they're just reminding you of another practical issue. Infant mortality was very high. And everyone understands that, so, you know, I mean, you know, and everyone agrees that we need a large family, even if it isn't some, you know, rich person or whatnot. Just, I mean, there's a field that needs to be hoed. Yeah, you know, and so, yeah, I mean, so just all the things that reinforce approaching this in a very matter-of-fact fashion, very practical fashion.
A lot of wisdom in that there was no sixth adjutant influencing these times.
Yeah, it's just, you know, how problematic would over-spiritualized beings have been in these early times? You would have short-circuited all this, none of us would be here. And you know, we all would have died out millennia ago. And of course, but again, that's why the book is in our lap. We are more spiritualized now, and civilization is in jeopardy because of it.
This was the sheltered
baby. Right.
Also, we have Christian missionaries going into less advanced areas.
Right. We got all of these. Right. We know how the book talks about these developmental issues. It's just endless, right? How we're our own worst enemies in just all kinds of different ways. Yeah. To the point where it literally mobilized super universe level beings to compose a book to put in my lap to try to warn me about what we're about to do to ourselves. Okay, final paragraph here.
Human customs evolve, but very slowly. The purpose of a harem was to build up a strong and numerous body of blood kin for the support of the throne. A certain chief was once convinced that he should not have a harem, that he should be contented with one wife, so he promptly dismissed his harem. The dissatisfied wives went to their homes, and their offended relatives swept down on the chief in wrath and did away with him then and there.
Yeah. Wasn't I just saying how problematic it would be if some idealism started to creep into this state of affairs? Now, you know, and there, just, you know, you go back to the list. You know, the families are outraged because of breach of contract, right? Those are contractual ways. This is a serious breach of contract issue.
It's an economy.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the, you know, it's a funny little vignette. I think everyone remembers this poor progressive-minded guy who thinks, oh, you know, I should really be content with one life. Yeah, for the next 5 minutes that you live.
What's interesting is that's gotten to a level of abstraction, at least away from the Sex Act, you know.
Right, and like I was saying, see, that's important. Even if we have
a larger economy, you know.
Yeah. Even if we have initially kind of foolish notions that are away from the mere mating fact, you know, it's the beginning of the potential. You know, first, you have to think abstractly. Then you have to think abstractly well. You know? But you can't do it well before you can't do it. Right. So that's the evolutionary process. Okay, so next time then we'll get to the crescendo that we've been building up to, that second of the four indispensables of true monogamy.
What are the other two?
True religion, true monogamy, prayer, and God consciousness. And remember, God consciousness is so far above God knowingness that it's really kind of incomprehensible. That's why it's the eighth of the eight, the most advanced. That's a very, very extremely high philosophic state of mind to get to God consciousness. let's take a moment here, everyone, and maybe reflect a little bit on the history of marriage.